further ado, I'll introduce our speaker. We have with us Miranda Lupien. She's a graduate student here at Harvard in the Regional Studies Program, the Regional Studies of Russia, Eastern Europe, and Central Asia Master's Program. And she's an Innovation Fellow with the Davis Center's Imperia Project. Her research interests include internet technology regulation and use in Russia, Russian foreign policy, GIS, digital humanities, optical character recognition, and automation. So please join me in giving her a warm welcome. Woo!
Go, Maureen. Hi, everyone. Thank you so much to Jeff for organizing this, and obviously to Dr. Neal for all her help with this project. So I'm Miranda. I'm going to talk a little bit today about semi-automated toponym extraction in historical maps using the Google Cloud Vision API. And so just before I dive into the presentation, the goal of our research was really to come up with a semi-automated extraction process that's accessible and also fairly easy, which sounds really simple, but for those of you that are familiar with the problem, know that this is really no simple task at all. But before I dive into the research, I want to talk a little bit about what I am. Jeff gave a great introduction, so I won't restate that. I'm an Innovation Fellow with the Imperia Project, which is the geospatial history project that seeks to map the Russian Empire that's run by Dr. Kelly O'Neill. I'm also pretty comfortable with Python, I'm pretty comfortable with ArcGIS, and obviously I'm a huge fan of Baby Yoda. We'll come back to him, I promise. But what I'm not is also really important. So I'm not a machine learning or a computer vision expert. And that's important for two reasons. On the technical level, if you have questions about the model that Google's using, like how many cooling layers there are, just shoot me that question in an email. I'm in contact with the Google team that's developing this product. I'll get you an answer, but I might not know that answer off the top of my head. The second and perhaps more salient reason why this is important, again, kind of links back to our goal of developing a process that's really accessible. The idea being that you don't need highly specialized knowledge to be able to leverage this kind of technology and extract toponyms. So the idea being that if I can do it, you know, you can probably do it too. And before I really get into the nitty-gritty of the presentation, I want to define two terms for you. The first is maps. When I refer to maps, I typically mean historical documents that were manually produced on paper prior to World War II. And these documents, within the last 10, 20 years, many of them have been digitized, right? They've been scanned in an effort to preserve these documents and also to make them more accessible, you know, to researchers who may want to look at them remotely. And we believe that there's probably upwards of 500,000 of these digital scanned historical documents. They're probably sitting on library servers and archive servers and university servers. And again, this is a really conservative estimate. And these documents are exciting because many of them boast valuable and untapped geographic information. For instance, settlements that have yet to be recorded in a gazetteer or a definitive list of a feature type for a given place and a given time. But the barrier to recording these settlements comes in the form of feature extraction. And I'm going to just give a really brief definition of what that is. So feature extraction is the process by which we identify the features. In our case, that's toponyms or place names. We extract the features, so we turn them into sort of a usable digital entity, a piece of data. And then we also geocode those features. So we figure out, you know, if this is a historical point, for instance, here we have Warsaw, the capital of Poland. Where is Warsaw from 1827 located on a contemporary map? Luckily for us, it hasn't moved much. But this feature extraction process is often either really costly in terms of labor or time, or can require highly specialized technical knowledge. And so in that way, feature extraction can be both a prerequisite and a barrier to meaningful analysis of these documents. And existing extraction techniques generally fall into two categories, manual and then some sort of existing semi-automated processes. And I want to review both of those categories really quickly to show you where our potential third option might fit in. So the first extraction method, I'm sure you guys are familiar with it, is manual extraction. And oftentimes this can mean a researcher sitting down with that digital map on GIS software and manually extracting the features. So if that's toponyms, manually sitting there and typing out the toponym points and then, you know, geocoding them on a map. One study showed that extracting all of the features from a typical nautical chart would take you roughly 6 hours. So if you're paying a research assistant, let's say $20 an hour, that one single map sheet's gonna cost you $120. And let's say you have 100 map sheets that you're interested in extracting that data from, you're looking at $12,000, which is, you know, not a small sum of money, to put it lightly. So this manual extraction process can be really time consuming and can also be really costly. The second sort of existing feature extraction method that we talk about is semi-automated. And there are a few different lines of inquiry that we've seen in existing research. The first is trying to leverage traditional optical character recognition software to semi-automate the process of extracting toponyms. And this can be quite challenging because traditional OCR software was built to deal with black and white text documents. It's built to deal primarily with documents that maybe have text in one language, and all that text is going in straight lines across the page. You know, some OCR software can deal with charts, but it certainly cannot deal with the complexities that we see, for instance, in this excerpt of one of our maps on the screen. So you have different languages, you have different fonts, different sizes of text. You know, the text is going in all different directions. If you look in that white box on the bottom left-hand corner of that image there, you see you have the name of a river, and that's almost sort of curvilinear. You have different colors and variations in illumination and symbols. Not to mention that when we're scanning these documents to digitize them, that scanning process itself can sometimes create noise, right? False coloration or blurring, and that noise can be exacerbated by compression of these files. So traditional OCR software really can't deal with the complexities of these map documents. So the second sort of approach under this umbrella is to for researchers to develop their own extraction models and tailor these models to their map sets. And that requires obviously a high degree of specialized knowledge, right? You're tackling complex questions in computer vision and OCR. And again, because maps are such specific and different documents, these processes are typically tailored to one map set. So you can't simply take an algorithm that one research team developed and apply it to your own map set. And again, developing these custom processes can be really hard. In a survey of digital humanities practitioners, participants frequently cited programming, coding, and software development as skills that they wrestled with acquiring. You know, and that's not to say that there aren't really, really qualified and really knowledgeable DH and digital history teams out there that can develop these models, but that's just not the case at every institution. And so developing these custom processes can be really hard. And I'd say a final sort of potential pitfall of this custom semi-automated approach is that this helps to proliferate the siloing of digital humanities teams or digital history teams across institutions. Because what you're doing is you're reinventing the wheel, albeit a slightly different wheel for slightly different map sets, a number of times. And so rather than trying to develop our own custom models to extract the features from our map sets, we focused on thinking about a potential method that other teams would be able to easily apply to their own map sets. And so I should also note just that at this point in time, the noise in digital map documents and just the variation across digital map documents generally makes it impossible to fully automate map processing in a sort of complete and universal way. So when I talk about semi-automated feature extraction, I mean the extraction of these toponyms, but then that might require research to go back and to correct some of the data that we see. But again, turning back to our potential third method, we thought that a prepackaged commercial algorithm that had both image processing capabilities and optical character recognition capabilities could significantly lower the expertise and resource barriers required to automate toponym extraction. And so we decided to experiment with Google's Cloud Vision API. This would be our prepackaged product. And we chose this particular product as opposed to other commercially available options for three reasons. First, it's fairly easy to use. In the version of the product that we used, we didn't have to train any models. We didn't have to have a lot of training data, which can obviously be a barrier to getting these models up and running. It was also fairly easy to integrate. Now, there is no graphical user interface, for this particular product, but Google provides you with the code samples that you need to implement it. So even if your programming level is kind of like print hello world, I still think that you could probably successfully implement this API programmatically, or you can run it from the command line. And the other great part of using a commercial product is that there is a dedicated team of people who are paid to help you implement this product, which is not always the case, as you know, for open source software. And I've been in contact with them. They're very responsive. The second reason that we selected this particular product is that it's effective. So in a study of the 11 leading commercial vision platforms that included peer products like Amazon's version of this product and Microsoft's version of this product, Google was the only product to rank first in all 11 categories, including ease of use and including performance of the model. It also offers extensive foreign language support, which is really important for historical maps. I think it currently offers upwards of 50 support for 50 languages, and more languages are in beta testing. And what's really important for us is that it supports Russian in the old orthography. Now, what this means is that prior to the 1917 revolution in Russia, there were a few extra characters in the Russian alphabet that aren't used today, but obviously are present in our maps, which are from the 19th century. So it was really important that this product offered support for those characters, and Google's Cloud Vision API was one of the few that really did. And the final reason that we selected this particular product is that it's really cheap, and in many cases, it's actually free. So teams get 1,000 free images or free calls to the API, so to speak, a month. So that could be about 1,000 map sheets per month. So the only way you're going to incur costs is if, on average, you're processing more than 12,000 map sheets a year. And if you're doing that, that's exciting, you're probably superhuman. So each additional 1,000 calls per month after you exceed that first 1,000 calls is only $1.50. So it really is a cost-effective solution, even for institutions that don't necessarily have a large budget to purchase subscriptions to these types of technology products. And I want to talk now a little bit about the data that we used to test the Google Cloud Vision product on. So we selected four atlas sheets from the 1827 Geographical Atlas of the Russian Empire. So each of these sheets is a province or a kingdom within the larger Russian Empire. And we selected these sheets because we wanted to test a variety of language combinations, font combinations, and geospatial patterns with respect to settlements. Each of these sheets has roughly 280 toponym pairs, or settlements reported in two languages. So each settlement on this sheet has its name written twice, once in Russian and once in a second language. And I'll go into a little bit more detail on that in a second. So across all four sheets, we had a sample of 2,260 toponyms to analyze. And I'm going to go through these sheets really quickly and just talk about some of the interesting features. So this is the Kazan province, and toponyms are written in Russian and in a Latin transliteration. The font, as you can see in this sort of excerpt here, is mostly cursive, and the settlements are sort of unevenly distributed. So there's significantly more settlements in the southern and western portion of the province than there are in the northern portion. And also you have these really prominent, really dark intervening features in the form of rivers or boundaries. The next atlas sheet we looked at was for the Minsk province. And here toponyms are written in Russian and Polish, and there's a good mix of block and cursive font. And settlements are more evenly distributed throughout the province than they are in the Kazan sheet. The third atlas sheet we looked at was the Moscow province. Again, toponyms are written in Russian and a Latin transliteration, and the font is mostly cursive. But what was really interesting to us about this sheet was the way that the settlements are clustered. So it is there are a number of settlements on this particular sheet. It's really sort of densely packed, but they're all pretty regularly spaced in these rings that sort of center on the province capital of Moscow. So that pattern was particularly interesting to us. And the final atlas sheet we looked at was the Kingdom of Poland. The toponyms are written in Russian and Polish. They're mostly in print font, which is a departure from the other three sheets. And they tend to be more dispersed, although there is some clustering in the kingdom capital of Warsaw in the center there. There are also significantly fewer intervening features. So in terms of our testing process, we used Python to make our calls to the API, and we wrote a simple script that returned us two documents. First, it returned us a copy of the image that was annotated with bounding boxes around the text that the algorithm identified. And we had the program label each of those bounding boxes with a number. Then we also had the program return us the CSV, which had the text that was transcribed and also the number, so that we could visually connect what was on the CSV to what was on the map. And we assessed two metrics, detection performance and transcription performance. Detection performance, pretty simple. How good was the model at detecting toponyms? You know, how many toponyms did it fail to record even a single character of? And transcription performance is a little bit more complicated in terms of a metric. So there we're asking, how well did the OPI transcribe the text that it identified? And we rated each text instance as either correct, there were no errors, partially correct, there were 1 to 3 errors, or incorrect, meaning that either there were more than 3 errors, or the toponym was recorded in the wrong alphabet. And that partially correct category is a little interesting. We included it because we did feel like in some cases, when there's 1 or 2 errors, it's fairly easy to correct that toponym name and takes less time than it would to extract that toponym by hand. For the transcription performance, we also had a number of different error types that describe the type of error that we saw. For instance, it was recorded in the wrong alphabet, or there's missing characters, or the toponym itself was clipped. We also noted the feature type. We are primarily interested in settlements, so not, for instance, the names of rivers, the language, and the font that the text was written in, because again, we think these probably could have bearing on the transcription performance. So I want to first talk about the detection results. So this is a chart that shows you the results for each of the Atlas sheets, and we have, again, the number of toponym pairs. So remember that each toponym is recorded in two different languages, so those two toponyms form a single toponym pairs. And we were interested in how many times the algorithm missed only one toponym in the pair and how many times it missed both toponyms in the pair. And then also just the total number of toponyms missed. We were surprisingly pleased with the results. You can see that on average, the model missed only roughly 6% of all toponyms in the sheet, which given the linguistic and font and geospatial complexities of these map sheets is pretty remarkable. The sheet that had the worst performance was the Kazan sheet, and I think that's partially because of the prevalence of those intervening features, which can disrupt or overlap with text and prevent accurate detection. The Kingdom of Poland sheet had the lowest percent of all toponyms missed, and also recall that that's the sheet that had the fewest intervening features and sort of the most white space. But there were some results that we found a little bit difficult to understand, and I'm going to give you 3 quick examples, and I'd love if you guys have any feedback on why this might be occurring. So for instance, you can see here this is an excerpt from our Minsk Atlas sheet, and the algorithm failed to detect that top toponym pair, Izhi, but it accurately detected the sort of bottom toponym pair of Naruch. And it's interesting because both of those toponym pairs are written in the same languages, and they're written in the same block font, they're about the same size, and they have pretty similar background colors. So this was a little bit of a puzzle to us. Similarly, this is an excerpt from the Moscow Atlas sheet. The algorithm correctly detected Platova, that toponym pair on the top there that's intersected by that nice dark black line, but failed for some reason to detect Dubrovka, despite the fact that it looks like there are significantly fewer intervening features in that bottom toponym pair. Although there is the sort of the small river that runs through it, and that settlement symbol to the right of the toponym pair that might have played a role in that. And then one more example of this. This is an excerpt from the Poland Atlas sheet, and the algorithm detected only one toponym in the toponym pair. It detected the toponym written in Polish, but not the version of that toponym written in Russian. And again, there are sort of significantly more intervening features in that top toponym in the pair, but still, we weren't entirely sure, or wasn't entirely clear to us, rather, why the toponym or the model sometimes failed to detect these instances of text that to the human eye are pretty clear. I also want to talk about the transcription results. Now, I know some of these numbers look a little low, but don't be dismayed, because when we break this out by language and font group, you're going to see that some of these language font groups performed quite well, while others significantly brought down the average in terms of performance. So what I would note here is that the Kazan Atlas sheet had the worst performance, right, with roughly 17% of all toponyms correctly transcribed. And we think this has to do in part with the prevalence of Russian cursive toponyms, which we believe were probably not prevalent in the training data. So in the data that was used to train the Google model, because we know that much of the data that was used to train the model that Google uses comes from the Google Books project, which is a lot of print material that's written in, you know, in block font, not necessarily in cursive. So we think that that's part of the issue, and I'm going to talk a lot more about that in a slide or two. The Atlas sheet that performed the best was the Kingdom of Poland. So we saw roughly 55% of all toponyms transcribed correctly. Only 15% were transcribed incorrectly, and 30% had three or fewer errors in transcription. And again, remember that that's the Atlas sheet with the sort of the most white space and the fewest intervening features. So this is a chart that breaks down our transcription results by font and then by language. So the first distinction we have is the top of the chart versus the bottom part of the chart. So cursive versus not cursive, or cursive versus block. And then within the font groups, we also break the results out by language. So we have Latin transliteration, Polish, and Russian. And the first thing to note looking at this chart is that the sample is roughly two-thirds cursive and one-third block. So in the future, we would like to be working with a little bit more Atlas sheets, rather, that have toponyms that tend to be written in block font, just to try to balance that out a little bit. The second thing that you might notice is that compared to toponyms written in cursive font, toponyms that are written in block font performed better across the board, regardless of language. So our best performing font language group was Polish. So that's that row, that's the second from the bottom. And you can see there in that second column that 65% of the toponyms that were written in block font and in Polish were transcribed correctly. Only 2% were transcribed incorrectly, and 33% had three or fewer errors. So this is really exciting to us. There's a really strong performance on this particular language font group. The worst performing language font group is in the top half of that chart. It's the Russian cursive, which with only 3% of toponyms accurately transcribed. So let's talk about why. And to do that, I want to talk about the two most common types of errors that we saw. The first is script classification, which was simply the algorithm decided to transcribe Cyrillic text in the Latin alphabet. And the second error that we saw quite frequently was simply the transcription of the wrong character, albeit in the correct script. So I'll start by talking about script classification in a little bit of detail. So you can kind of see why this might occur. The orange letters indicate letters that have lookalikes in the other alphabet. So the A in the Latin alphabet sure looks a lot like the A in the Cyrillic alphabet. And remember that these are only capital letters in a single font. So when you introduce lowercase letters and you introduce other fonts, and maybe you introduce some of the characters that are specific to the Polish alphabet, you can see how this further complicates script classification. And these errors are partially a result of the way that the model classifies the language or alphabet of the text and then transcribes the text. So the CloudVision API first identifies the script of the text, for instance, Cyrillic or Latin or Greek or Mandarin, and then based on that classification, it sends that text instance to an OCR model that is specific to that alphabet. So here we can see we have this lovely Russian toponym, Kamenskaya, and it was sent to the script classification model. And within that model, the algorithm sort of analyzed this piece of text and probably said, okay, it looks like there's a K, it looks like there's an A, probably an H, an M. That's probably written in the Latin alphabet. And so it was then sent with that Latin script classification to the model that deals with transcribing text in the Latin alphabet. So once you get past that script classification model, if you have the wrong classification, that's it. You're past the point of no return, which is in part how we ended up with Kaninchos, rather than Kamianskaya. And Google has actually documented issues stemming from the high prevalence of lookalike characters in Latin and Cyrillic. So in a 2017 paper comparing different script selection approaches, so different approaches for that script classification model, Google found that the best performing model for script identification of Cyrillic text in photos still had a nearly 30% error rate, while the worst performing model had a 50% error rate. So our findings aren't surprising, but they also suggest that cursive text may amplify existing script identification issues caused by lookalike characters. So these are two graphs that break out the toponyms by the type of font that they're printed in. On the left here, we have cursive. On the right here, we have block. And that gray bar indicates script classification errors per toponym. So for the cursive sample, that rate was 0.42 script classification errors for every toponym in that sample. On the right side, we have 0.11 script classification issues for errors, rather, for every toponym in the block text sample. So you can see that the rate is much higher for cursive, where, you know, the letters tend to be more connected, there's less white space between them, it could be more difficult to differentiate or to identify. The second major type of error that we saw was a character identification error. And again, I have these two graphs. On the left is our cursive font toponyms, and on the right is our toponyms in block font, and that orange bar represents character identification issues. And we were surprised that these rates were pretty similar, 0.34 for cursive, and I think 0.32 for block. We expected that the algorithm would struggle to correctly identify cursive's connected letters. But we didn't count script classification errors as character identification errors, even though the selection of the wrong script sort of stems from a character recognition issue. So if we had considered all script identification errors as character identification errors, then the cursive sample would actually have a much higher rate of character identification issues. But what this shows, perhaps, is that once you sort of get the correct script classification, that, you know, error rates don't necessarily differ substantially between fonts, which was kind of surprising for us. I want to just show you a few examples of some of these character identification issues. So here we have a toponym written in a Latin transliteration, and you can see that that final C was transcribed by the algorithm as an S. So OCR shows you what the algorithm returned to us, and map is what's actually on the map. And it's kind of easy to understand why that happened. When you look at this example, you have that line running through it that acts as noise and probably is part of the reason that we have that incorrect transcription for the last character. Another example, this is a Grecian toponym, and the character that it confused was se. Now, se, for those of you that don't read or speak Russian, is this character that kind of looks like 3/4 of a box with a little tail, and it confused it with a pe. And if you look at these two characters in that top font, it's kind of difficult to understand why they might have been confused. You can easily distinguish between the two of them. But when you add serifs, those characters look a little bit more similar. And then when those serifs at the top of the vertical lines in the se touch, that looks like it's now a top bar. And that tail, well, maybe that tail is actually noise, right? And so this example shows you how font considerations can lead to incorrect character identification. This is another sort of example of that. Again, we have the letter tse, and this time the algorithm confused the letter tse with de, which is a D in Russian. And again, I think that font plays a role here, right? You do have those serifs, but you also have this intervening feature on the right that is a fairly thin line, but it creates the appearance of another tail on the character, and you can see that in that de letter there are two tails. So here it's a combination of font and intervening features that causes the character identification issue. Here's another example. What's written on the map is Plibova. What OCR came up with is Vispon, so very different sounding. And part of the issue here was that we had a false positive. So the algorithm thought that there was a character at the end that really doesn't exist. And again, it's kind of easy to see why this occurs when you zoom in on that particular toponym. So you have this intervening feature, this line that sort of forms the left bar and that H-looking character. And then to the right of that, you have this cross, which is a symbol of a settlement. And when you look at them in conjunction, you can kind of see, I outlined in red there, how they look like what looks to us to be an H, but it's actually an N in Russian. So here's an example of a false positive. So the settlement in combination with this line sort of forms an additional character. I also just want to note really quickly that there are significant differences within font groups if you break it down by language. So here's a graph showing error types and frequencies within the cursive font sample. And you can see that that gray bar, which represents script classification errors, is significantly higher for Russian cursive text than for Polish cursive text or for Latin cursive text. That bar comes in at a rate of 0.8 script identification errors for each toponym that's written in Russian cursive. So this one particular language font combination drives up the error rate for the whole font group. This is really sort of a significant distinction that we can make between languages, and also just shows you how much the algorithm struggled with Russian cursive font. I want to say one more thing about transcription before I move to conclude here, and that's that geography matters. So what you're looking at right here are toponyms from the Kazan sample on your left and the Moscow sample on your right. And both of these sets of toponyms are written in Russian, and they're both written in block font. And yet, on the left, for these types of toponyms, the model only got 14% of them correct. But for the toponyms on the right, the model got 41% of them correct, which is pretty decent. So what's the difference? It's geography. It's the presence of intervening features. You can see that the toponyms on the left are bisected and intersected by significantly more intervening features than for those toponyms on the right. Now, the exception to that on the right is text instance 460, which says Moskva, which is simply the Russian word for Moscow. And we think that the algorithm was correctly able to transcribe Moskva, despite the fact that it has this giant, thick black line running through it, because Moskva was probably present in the test data. Moskva, Moscow, it's a fairly frequent word. The spelling of it has not changed since the 19th century. So this also testifies to the importance of what is going into the training data to train the model. So in conclusion, we would say that it worked pretty well on our Atlas sheets. And that's not just because I've put more than 100 hours of my life into this project. And that there's definitely a place for this type of approach, especially when you compare it to other existing approaches, right? So I have the manual approach up there, the sort of semi-automated custom approach on there, and then our approach. And compared to the manual, it requires significantly less effort to extract toponyms, although it does require more effort to correct the toponyms after the fact, but not necessarily more effort than correction for some custom models requires, at least based on what's in the literature. It also requires significantly less labor for system development, or sort of developing the process by which you extract those toponyms, right? And correspondingly, it also requires less specialized knowledge, significantly less specialized knowledge, than developing a custom model will. But there are trade-offs, right? We saw, moderate accuracy, in some cases better, in some cases worse, depending on the language and font groups. But again, based on what we've read in the literature, sometimes the accuracy of the prepackaged method is not, that much worse than what we saw for some of these custom methods on some map sheets. We also think it could work even better on maps that meet certain characteristics, right? So firstly, when toponyms are all written in a single script, because then the user can specify the language in a language hint to the API call, which is going to force the program to rely only on the transcription model associated with the language that's provided. So you're going to ideally see zero script classification errors if you have all toponyms written in a single alphabet and you're able to specify that alphabet to the API. Second, we saw significantly better performance for toponyms written in block text, probably linked to the training data that was used to train the model. And third, we think that performance will be better if toponyms are printed in, sort of roughly speaking, a more common language. widely and currently used language tend to generate more written material that can serve as model training data. And Google, understandably, is prioritizing training the model with data in languages, which draw a larger commercial customer base than old orthographic Russian does. We also think that pre and post processing steps may help. And this is kind of where we're at in the research, so we'd love to get your feedback on this in Q&A. And many of these pre and post processing steps could be implemented either using GIMP, which has a user interface, it's a photo editing software, or programmatically, for instance, in Python using scikit-image or Python Imaging Library or OpenCV. The first potential pre-processing step we've discussed is a noise removal filter. We expect that Google's algorithm is using some sort of automated process to try to remove noise from your image, but at the end of the day, you are still more familiar with your maps than the algorithm is. You better understand the type of noise that's present in your maps and where that noise came from than the algorithm does. So you might want to send an image to the API that already has its noise, or that already, rather, you've put a noise removal filter on. And I would just caution against using, for instance, the popular Gaussian filter, which is going to reduce detail and image noise by blurring, right? For best OCR performance, we want to maintain sharp character borders and a high foreground background contrast. So a bilateral filter or a median filter that's going to preserve edges is probably going to be a better option. The second thing that we've discussed at length is custom thresholding, and I won't go into detail here, but if you have questions or want to talk about that in Q&A, that would be awesome. It suffices to say that if your toponyms are written in a distinctive shade of gray or a distinctive color, you might be able to select a thresholding value that's really going to accentuate those toponyms and separate them from the background and make processing a little bit easier. And some post-processing steps we've discussed. The first would be filtering it against a gazetteer, if one exists. So here's an example of what that might look like. You have your text instances that were returned from the model. You have your authoritative list. Where there's overlap, you can assume those are correct. So you're cutting down on the time it takes to go through and correct or check the text instances that were returned by the algorithm. When the text instance does not appear in the authoritative list, either it's just not yet recorded, like Plainview in this example, or maybe it was spelled incorrectly, like Hampton Bays in this example. The second post-processing step we've discussed is writing a simple program to correct for toponyms that are transcribed in the Latin alphabet when they're actually Cyrillic, because we know which characters are most frequently mixed up. So if we can say this toponym has a script classification error, let's send it through this program. And that program, for instance, replaces every Latin H with a Russian N, replaces every Latin O with a Russian O, and so on and so forth. That'll help to cut down on the time that it takes to correct for script identification or script classification, error. So again, these are just some steps that we're discussing and we'd love to get more feedback on. I told you I would come back to him. But in conclusion, we believe that as machine learning and image processing technology only improves, that these types of prepackaged products are also only going to get better. And so there's a lot more research that needs to be done to figure out how we can leverage these products for semi-automated toponym extraction. And we believe that truly semi-automated toponym extraction has never been, one, closer, and two, more accessible for everyone. And the payoff still remains really high, right? Unlocking probably tens of thousands of points that have yet to be recorded. So thank you. Thank you.